The Golden Raven by Nora Sakovic has become something of a cult phenomenon amongst sports fiction enthusiasts, with readers across social media platforms creating elaborate fan theories about the complex characters and their relationships. What makes this novel particularly fascinating is how it builds upon the author's previous works while standing firmly on its own merits. Sakovic's ability to weave together themes of trauma, identity, and belonging has earned her praise from critics and a devoted following that includes several professional athletes who have cited her work as surprisingly accurate in depicting the psychological pressures of competitive sports. In a literary landscape often dominated by straightforward sports narratives, this book dares to explore the darker underbelly of athletic excellence and the human cost of pursuing perfection. Jean Moreau arrives at USC Trojans practice carrying more than just physical injuries from Grayson Johnson's attack. He carries the psychological weight of years spent at Edgar Allan University's XE team, the Ravens, a program defined by brutal discipline and dehumanizing practices. When teammate Xavier offers Jean ibuprofen for pain, Jean's reaction reveals the depth of his conditioning. Medication at Edgar Allan was strictly controlled, used as both reward and punishment. Jean's revelation that he received no treatment for a serious LCL injury shocks his new teammates, exposing the stark contrast between Raven and Trojan culture. The Ravens operated under a system designed to break players down and rebuild them as perfect extensions of their coach's will. Jean was acquired by the Ravens at age 16, essentially purchased from his parents and forced to sign a contract he never read. His identity was systematically stripped away. He was assigned a number, 3, given a facial tattoo marking him as Raven property, and subjected to constant surveillance and punishment. As Jean explains to Jeremy, Ravens do not have families, highlighting how the program deliberately isolated players from any support system outside the team. Most disturbing is the casual violence that permeated Raven culture. Under the leadership of Riko Moriyama and his uncle, Coach Tetsuji, players were subjected to calculated punishments for even minor infractions. Jean bears both visible and invisible scars from this system, his body mapped with evidence of beatings, his mind conditioned to expect punishment for the slightest deviation from perfection. When Jean nearly strikes a freshman player during practice, we glimpse how deeply ingrained these violent responses have become. Though Jean manages to catch himself before completing the action. The Ravens' abusive culture extended beyond physical violence to psychological manipulation. Players were housed in underground dormitories nicknamed The Nest, with identical rooms and constant red lighting that Jean describes as making his blood look black on Rico's bedroom floor. This environment fostered what Jean calls a team of individuals who were sharp-edged and shattered and fused together into a new whole, like stained glass, beautiful but fundamentally broken. Jean's transition to the Trojans represents more than just a team transfer. It's a complete paradigm shift that challenges everything he's been conditioned to believe about himself, his worth, and his identity as an athlete. The process begins with small revelations, discovering he can eat without calculating exact nutritional values, realizing mistakes won't result in physical punishment, and learning that his teammates genuinely care about his well-being rather than just his performance. These moments of realization accumulate slowly. When Kat encourages Jean to trust his own judgment about food, telling him small errors won't result in punishment, we witness Jean's tentative steps toward autonomy. Similarly, when teammates Derek and Derek playfully call Jean Lil Bro and continue their good-natured teasing even after he trips them in retaliation, Jean seems bewildered by interactions that contain affection rather than malice. Jean's healing journey is neither linear nor simple. He struggles with claustrophobia, swimming phobia, and deep-seated trust issues. Through Dr. Dobson's referral, Jean begins exposure therapy to address his swimming fears, a process that leaves him visibly shaken but represents his commitment to recovery. When Jeremy promises to drive Jean to his weekly appointments for the next 3 to 4 months, it symbolizes the consistent support Jean needs to heal. Perhaps the most significant breakthrough comes when Coach Riemann apologizes for not protecting Jean better during an incident with an opposing player. This moment of compassion breaks something fundamental inside Jean as he realizes he is not the one who should apologize to me. Despite desperate attempts to maintain control, Jean shatters when Riemann tells him, "You're safe. I've got you. Let go." This permission to be vulnerable, to finally release the rigid self-control that kept him alive at Evermore, marks a turning point in Jean's recovery. By the novel's end, Jean can admit aloud during therapy, "I deserve to get better." This simple statement represents enormous progress for someone who was conditioned to believe his only value lay in perfect performance on the court. Jean draws strength from Jeremy's promise of 1 week at a time, suggesting that healing doesn't require immediate transformation, but rather consistent small steps forward. The USC Trojans represent everything the Ravens are not, a team built on mutual respect, support, and genuine joy in the sport. Where the Ravens demanded perfect obedience, the Trojans encourage individual growth. Where the Ravens used fear as motivation, the Trojans foster belonging and trust. This contrast provides the foundation for Jean's gradual transformation. Jeremy Knox, the Trojans' captain, embodies this different approach to leadership. Unlike Rico, who ruled through fear, Jeremy leads through example and genuine care for his teammates. When Jean observes the Trojans during their first home game, he finally understands what makes them special. They give ground when needed, but never cede control, focusing on their own game rather than reacting to opponents' aggression. This approach, valuing adaptability over rigid perfection, challenges everything Jean learned at Evermore. The Trojans' inclusive culture extends beyond the court. When Xavier reveals his transgender identity to Jean, Jean's response is refreshingly straightforward. Since it has no impact on how he plays, he says it's my prerogative to fix whatever's broken. He doesn't understand why he should have an opinion on my personal life. Xavier delightedly tells Jeremy, "I like him. Let's keep him forever," highlighting how the Trojans value people for who they are rather than just their athletic contributions. Even the Trojans' approach to improvement differs fundamentally from the Ravens. When Jean offers to teach Raven drills after practice, several teammates voluntarily join these sessions to learn. Rather than forcing conformity through punishment, the Trojans embrace opportunities to grow through mutual exchange of knowledge. Coach Riemann supports this initiative while ensuring players don't overextend themselves, a stark contrast to Raven practices that pushed athletes beyond their physical limits. The team's response to adversity further demonstrates their cohesive culture. When Lila and Kat's house burns down, likely targeted because of Jean's connection to them, the entire team rallies to support them. From offering temporary housing to helping replace lost possessions, the Trojans demonstrate that their bonds extend beyond mere teammates to chosen family. This sense of belonging provides Jean with something he never experienced at Edgar Allan: unconditional acceptance. Jeremy Knox initially appears as the perfect counterpoint to Raven culture, optimistic, supportive, and seemingly unburdened by the darkness that haunts Jean. Yet, as the story unfolds, we discover Jeremy carries his own complicated past, including family trauma, substance abuse issues, and the weight of political expectations tied to his family name. Jeremy's family dynamics reveal layers of complexity beneath his sunny exterior. His mother, Matilda, and stepfather, Warren, pressure him to attend law school despite his passion for Exe, with his stepbrother, Bryson, even threatening to plant incriminating evidence in Jeremy's room if he doesn't deliberately fail the LSAT. Their family dinners are fraught with tension, casual racism, and homophobia that Jeremy endures while maintaining his composure. Most significant is Jeremy's connection to his brother Noah's suicide. When confronted about his past with White Ridge's Rusty Connors, Jeremy confesses his role in outing several players, which led to devastating consequences. The revelation that "we all knew about Noah's depression but couldn't get their parents to listen" haunts Jeremy, particularly his angry thought that they'd only pay attention when they lost Noah. This guilt, combined with his subsequent substance abuse and rehabilitation, adds depth to Jeremy's character beyond the perfect captain facade. Despite these struggles, Jeremy demonstrates remarkable resilience and growth. 4 years sober, he maintains boundaries with his toxic family while building genuine connections with his teammates. His promise to Jean, "I'd rather die than be that person again," reflects his commitment to personal accountability. Jean's simple response, "You are you, I believe you," establishes a foundation of mutual trust that strengthens throughout the novel. Jeremy's leadership style stands in stark contrast to both his family's political machinations and Rico's tyrannical approach. He leads through genuine care and respect, earning his team's loyalty rather than demanding it. When Xavier questions why Jeremy won't pressure Jean to speak publicly about Raven's abuses, Jeremy firmly refuses. He's scared of Edgar Allan. "I'm not going to force him into a confrontation he's not ready to have." This respect for boundaries demonstrates Jeremy's understanding that true leadership means supporting others' healing journeys rather than exploiting their trauma for advantage. At its heart, The Golden Raven explores how people create home and family when their biological families have failed them. For Jean, Kat, Lila, and Jeremy, this process involves learning to trust again after profound betrayals and building connections that transcend the traditional boundaries of friendship and teamwork. Jean's journey toward trust begins with small moments. Kat teaching him to ride motorcycles, Lila braiding his hair as he once did for his sister Elodie, Jeremy driving him to therapy appointments without question. These consistent acts of care gradually convince Jean that the Trojans' support isn't conditional on his performance. When the team responds to his television interview with support rather than fear or rejection, Jean experiences, perhaps for the first time, what it means to be valued for himself rather than just his athletic ability. The burning of Lila and Kat's house represents a pivotal moment in this journey. Despite losing their physical home, the four maintain their connection to each other, demonstrating that home exists in relationships rather than locations. When they move into a sterile new apartment, they immediately begin transforming it into a space that reflects their shared identity. From furniture shopping to adopting a dog named Jabberwocky, these seemingly mundane activities represent their commitment to building a life together despite trauma and loss. Perhaps the most touching symbol of this new family forms around Jabberwocky, the dog Jeremy adopts with Jean's reluctant accompaniment. Despite Jean's initial protests that it's your beast, not mine, the dog persistently tries to settle in Jean's lap. When Kat jokingly calls the animal Jabberwocky Moreau, Jean's objection gives way to acceptance. If he is going to be a Moreau, he will have to learn French. This small concession represents Jean's growing ability to embrace connection despite his conditioning against attachment. The novel concludes with Jean wrestling with Renee's question, "Whose rules?" and Neil's assertion that the rules have changed. Though Jean reminds himself, "Not for me," he allows himself, just for a moment, to pretend otherwise, suggesting that he's beginning to imagine a future where he might define his own boundaries rather than living by those imposed by others. This tentative hope, combined with the domestic scene of Jeremy playing with their dog while Jean watches contentedly, offers a glimpse of what home might truly mean for someone who has been denied it for so long. Throughout the novel, Exie serves as more than just a sport. It's a lens through which to examine how institutions can both nurture and destroy the individuals within them. The contrast between Ravens and Trojans illuminates broader questions about the price of excellence and what constitutes true athletic achievement. The Ravens represent the darkest extreme of athletic culture, valuing results above human dignity and sacrificing players' well-being for championship titles. Their approach produces undeniable results. They dominated collegiate Exie for years, but at a devastating human cost. The novel reveals a string of casualties beyond Jean: Rico's suicide, Harry Rogerson's death on a campus shuttle, Lyle Holden's nervous breakdown, and numerous other Ravens suffering physical and psychological breakdowns. When former Raven Theodora Moldani declares, "A Raven who cannot play is no Raven," she exposes the dehumanizing core of their philosophy. Players are valued solely for their performance, discarded when they can no longer contribute. The Trojans offer an alternative vision of athletic excellence, one that values growth, teamwork, and personal well-being alongside competitive success. Their approach isn't portrayed as soft or unambitious. They remain a top-ranked team with championship aspirations. Rather, they demonstrate that excellence and humanity aren't mutually exclusive. When Jean finally understands the Trojans' playing style during their first home game, he recognizes they are very good in a fundamentally different way than the Ravens, adaptive rather than rigid, collaborative rather than hierarchical. The novel doesn't shy away from examining how institutional structures enable abuse. The ERC, XE Regulation Committee, repeatedly fails to adequately address Ravens' violations, issuing insufficient penalties even after egregious incidents. Media coverage sensationalizes violence while ignoring underlying systemic issues. Even well-intentioned coaches like Wymack struggle to protect players within a system designed to prioritize entertainment and results over athlete welfare. Through Jean's perspective, we witness how deeply sports can shape identity, both constructively and destructively. For the Ravens, XE becomes all-consuming, erasing individual identity in service to the team. For the Trojans, it remains central to their lives, but exists alongside other values and relationships. Jean's gradual shift from defining himself solely as perfect court to embracing other aspects of his identity, his French heritage, his role as Kat and Layla's friend, even his reluctant connection to Jabberwocky, represents his evolving understanding of what truly matters beyond athletic achievement. As Jean begins healing with the Trojans, questions of justice and accountability loom large. What consequences should the Ravens face for years of abuse? Who bears responsibility for the system that enabled such treatment? And perhaps most challenging for Jean personally, how does one move forward while carrying the weight of such a past? The novel offers no simple answers. When Jean's parents are arrested by Interpol, apparently connected to the Butcher investigation, it represents a form of justice, but doesn't address the institutional failures that allowed Jean's abuse to continue for years. Similarly, when the ERC announces plans to eliminate the Ravens program, it feels like too little, too late, particularly as we learn about continued suffering among current Ravens players. Jean's personal struggle with accountability manifests in his complex relationships with former teammates. He maintains a complicated connection with Kevin Day, accepting his postcard despite claiming to hate him. Jean feels genuine grief over Zane, whose name he can barely speak. Even his reaction to Grayson Johnson's death is nuanced, relief that a monster is gone, but no celebration of his suffering. These responses suggest Jean understands the Ravens were both perpetrators and victims of a toxic system. The question of speaking out publicly becomes a recurring theme. Xavier urges Jeremy to have Jean reveal the truth about the master, Coach Tetsuji, believing public exposure is necessary for justice. Yet Jeremy refuses to pressure Jean, understanding that forcing him to confront his abusers before he's ready would only cause further harm. This tension between public accountability and personal healing remains unresolved throughout the novel, reflecting the real-world complexities of addressing institutional abuse. Perhaps the most profound exploration of justice comes through Jean's interactions with Lucas Johnson, whose brother Grayson had abused Jean at Evermore. When Lucas realizes Jean was only 16 when his brother attacked him, the horror on his face acknowledges the wrongness of what happened. Jeremy's gentle reminder to Lucas, "You are not your brother, and you are not responsible for what he did. Stop trying to carry that weight in his absence. It will only crush you," suggests that true justice includes breaking cycles of guilt and shame rather than perpetuating them. Throughout the novel, language serves as both barrier and bridge in Jean's journey toward belonging. As a French native speaker thrust into an English-speaking environment at Evermore with a single year to study English before being shoved into the deep end, Gene's relationship with language reflects his broader struggles with identity and connection. Gene's French becomes both shield and expression of his true self. When teaching Jeremy phrases like "je ne me sens pas bien," I don't feel well, to use at the banquet, if you need to leave, Gene shares something intimate, a linguistic escape route that represents growing trust. Similarly, when John speaks rapid French with a Canadian goalkeeper at the banquet, we glimpse his comfort and fluency when operating in his native tongue, free from the constraints of his second language. Language barriers create moments of vulnerability and connection. When John asks Jeremy for the English word for fireworks during the Independence Day celebration, their faces come unexpectedly close, creating an intimate moment as John's lips accidentally graze Jeremy's cheek. John's childlike curiosity about the fireworks, coupled with his admission, "This is good too," despite complaining he could have watched more Exi matches, reveals his gradual opening to experiences beyond the court. Communication extends beyond words to physical language as well. John braids Lila's hair in the same pattern he once used for his sister Elodie, transforming a painful memory into a gesture of comfort. When John kisses Kat's temple the same way she does to comfort him, he adopts the Trojan's physical vocabulary of affection. These nonverbal communications often express what John cannot yet articulate, his growing attachment to his new team, and his tentative steps toward trust. Perhaps most significant is John's evolving self-expression. Early in the novel, he speaks primarily in Raven terminology, perfect court, master, referring to himself as we when discussing ravens. Jeremy's gentle correction, "Don't you ever we the ravens again," marks the beginning of John's linguistic separation from his former identity. By the novel's end, John can admit, "I deserve to get better," and declare, if he is going to be a Moro, he will have to learn French about Jabberwocky, statements that reclaim both his individual identity and his heritage. For athletes whose identities have been consumed by their sport, discovering purpose beyond competition represents a profound challenge. The Golden Raven explores this theme through multiple characters, particularly Gene and Jeremy, as they navigate questions about their futures and what gives their lives meaning beyond Exi. Jeremy faces external pressure regarding his post-graduation plans, with his family insisting he attend law school despite his passion for professional Exi. When Gene confronts Jeremy about his LSAT study guides, insisting professional teams will fight to the death for Jeremy, he offers an alternative vision of Jeremy's worth, one based on genuine talent rather than family expectations. This moment of honest assessment touches Jeremy, who realizes Gene sees his true value as a player, untainted by political ambitions or family tradition. For Gene, whose entire existence has been defined by Exi, discovering interests beyond the court represents significant growth. His pottery class with Jeremy offers a new form of creative expression, where perfection isn't the goal. Though Gene struggles with the techniques, Professor Adrian praises his small cup, and Jeremy notices Gene seems calmer while working with the clay. This activity, purposeless from a Raven perspective, provides Gene with a space to explore creation without performance pressure. The novel also explores how trauma can both limit and expand one's worldview. Gene's experiences at Evermore narrowed his focus to survival, leaving little room for broader interests or future planning. Yet these same experiences give him unique insight into other struggles. When Xavier reveals his transgender identity, Gene's matter-of-fact acceptance stems partly from his understanding that personal identity has no bearing on athletic performance, a perspective shaped by his Raven training but transformed into something affirming rather than restrictive. By the novel's end, both Gene and Jeremy are beginning to imagine futures defined by choice rather than obligation or trauma. Jeremy's determination to finish his final season strong with the Trojans represents his commitment to finding purpose in the present moment rather than anxiously fixating on future expectations. Gene's consideration of selling his Raven-associated car and potentially buying a motorcycle suggests he's starting to make decisions based on his own preferences rather than external conditioning. These small steps toward autonomy hint at larger journeys of self-discovery beyond the novel's conclusion. Perhaps the most profound aspect of Gene's journey is his gradual rediscovery of joy, something systematically stripped from him during his years with the Ravens. From his childlike wonder at fireworks to his reluctant attachment to Jabberwocky, Gene slowly relearns how to experience pleasure without guilt or fear of punishment. Early in the novel, Gene's conditioning is evident in his inability to enjoy simple pleasures. He hides a peach in his locker, treasuring it because produce was strictly regulated at the nest. He calculates the nutritional content of Indian takeout before allowing himself to eat it. These moments reveal how thoroughly the Ravens controlled even basic human experiences like eating. The Trojans introduce Gene to joy through consistent, non-threatening exposure to positive experiences. Kat teaches him to ride motorcycles, an activity with no athletic purpose but plenty of exhilaration. Jeremy takes him to a pottery class, where creation rather than competition is the goal. When Gene experiences the Independence Day fireworks, his genuine curiosity and admission that this is good too represents a significant shift from his earlier dismissal of anything not related to Exy. Perhaps most telling is Gene's evolving relationship with Jabberwocky. Despite his initial protests that it's your beast, not mine, Gene gradually accepts the dog's affection. When Kat jokingly calls the animal Jabberwocky Leroux, Gene's objection gives way to acceptance as he declares the dog will need to learn French if he's to be a Moreau. This moment of playfulness, so different from Gene's earlier rigid demeanor, suggests he's beginning to embrace joy as a legitimate part of life rather than a dangerous distraction. The novel concludes with Gene watching contentedly as Jeremy plays with Jabberwocky. Though Gene reminds himself the rules haven't changed for him, he allows himself, just for a moment, to pretend otherwise. This tentative permission to imagine happiness represents perhaps his most significant healing, the belief that joy might be possible not just for others, but eventually for himself as well.